We would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Preborn. When a mother meets her baby on an ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, it's a divine connection, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. But she can't do it without our help. Preborn needs us, the pro-life community, to come alongside her. One ultrasound is just $28. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby, or visit preborn.com.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview. The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. Good morning. Well, happy Friday. Today is Friday, March 21st, and we've been continuing to talk about the subject of immigration and the mass deportations and, of course, the ridiculous activist judges in the United States and in district courts. And this is not just an American phenomenon, though, of so many different people that are trying to really infiltrate our borders. They don't assimilate, and they bring a different worldview, different philosophy, and essentially try to take over the culture and the country. This is also happening all over Europe, and in Ireland, specifically, Conor McGregor, who is a mixed martial arts fighter in Ireland, visited the White House this week, and he met with President Trump and actually spoke from the press briefing room. And of course, the mainstream media just slammed this as an anti-immigration rant. This was condemned by Irish leaders. He draws Irish leaders ire after anti-immigration comments. But let's be clear on what he actually said. This is Cut 5.
What is going on in Ireland is a travesty. Our government is the government of zero action with zero accountability. You know, our money is being spent on overseas issues that has nothing to do with the Irish people. The illegal immigration racket is running ravage on the country. There are rural towns in Ireland that have been overrun in one swoop, that have become a minority in one swoop. So issues need to be addressed. And the 40 million Irish Americans, as I said, need to hear this, because if not, there will be no place to come home and visit.
All right, well, let's welcome in Brian McCarthy, who's a contributor at The People's Cube. And Brian, you know, I think what Conor McGregor was saying there is a very fair assessment. That doesn't sound anti-immigration. It sounds very pro-border control and sovereignty.
Yeah, Irish people in general are very welcoming. It's one of our national phrases, you know, in Gaelic, it's Cead Míle Fáilte, which means 100,000 welcomes. And I think they've just had it now because people have taken advantage. And, you know, I come from a small town in Ireland, and there's a hotel we used to visit on Sundays near me. And for the last 20 years, it has served as an accommodation center from people from all over the world. They don't work. They're put up there just like they were in New York City. And they just, you know, given free rein. And McGregor he's kind of opened the floodgates, because it's the only news story in Ireland this week, the only news story, and the establishment is coming after him, just like they came after Trump. And it's satisfying to watch from me as an Irish immigrant here in the US, but they've gone full bore after him. And some people now who you would consider moderate have started to come out and say, well, look, I don't like Conor McGregor so much as a person, but what he's saying is has to be said.
Yeah, and I think that sums up how a lot of people feel about Trump, you know, honestly, where some, I mean, and there are tons of Americans absolutely love him, but there are some who say, well, you know, I don't necessarily prefer him or some of the stuff that he tweets, but what he's saying is absolutely spot on. And these are the types of leaders that are standing up for a national sovereignty, for borders, and for their country. I mean, Trump is America first, and it would stand to reason that an Irish leader should be Ireland first. I mean, this is just all about what it means to be a nation, have a national identity, and understand the problem of illegal immigration. So what is the current political landscape in Ireland? Because some are suggesting that Conor McGregor might run for office now, or, you know, and challenge kind of this establishment. What's going on?
Well, he is definitely challenging the establishment. The Irish presidency is very ceremonial. It doesn't have much power. That's what, you know, lots of people will tell you, the left will tell you. But then they'll ask the Irish president to speak out on Palestine. He spoke out when Elon Musk bought Twitter. So the position can be a bully pulpit, but it's largely ceremonial. Back to what I said, the floodgates have opened back there, and people are going to start to speak up now because of what he said. And I vent regularly to my friends here in the US. You know, the Irish fought British rule for 800 years, only to be conquered by rainbow flag European Union bureaucrats within 20. You know, we just, it's been amazing for me watching the transformation of where I grew up in the space of, you know, 20 years from, you know, an Ireland to someone who just, to a country that doesn't have any political backbone and does exactly what the European Union says they should do.
Wow, what a an amazing assessment, and so true. I mean, and this is where I think a lot of the conservatives overall, and we're not just obviously talking about what America means by conservative and, you know, fidelity to our U.S. Constitution, all of those things. We're talking about pre-political principles where it doesn't matter what nation or government is ultimately established. It matters whether or not they're preserving the rights of the people that our founders recognized are God-given. But that's true for everyone, not just Americans. And that concept didn't just begin 250 years ago. And so when Ireland is, and the Irish people are really tired of this, and they're tired of this ideology that is antithetical to rights that are God-given to the people of Ireland as well. Where did this really start, and how has Ireland come to see this kind of influx of mass migration? Because this isn't a new issue. I mean, people have been complaining about this for years.
No, it came up in the 90s when Ireland, you know, there was a referendum. I think it might have been the Maastricht Treaty or one of the treaties that they voted in, and the Irish people rejected it. And typical EU, they said, no, vote on it again. So the second time around, Ireland ratified it, and that literally opened all the borders and people can travel anywhere. My parents at the time were like, oh, this is great. We don't have to show our passport going to France on vacation now. But now, and once people figured out the scam and they figured out the generous welfare state in Ireland, what happens is you can land on an airplane in Ireland from anywhere in the world, probably most likely within the EU, and you can say that your passport is gone. It's been destroyed. You don't have a passport, and you can claim international protection. The Irish government will then take you at your word, and they'll put you in a local hotel, and they will give you food and accommodation, and you're free to do what you want. And you won't believe that until you research it. And you'll come back in a few days and go, oh my God, that was actually true. And it's happening all around. Hotels, guest houses are getting bought up all over Ireland. The government is filling them with people basically from the third world who have never contributed to Irish society. And Conor McGregor literally this week just broke the back of all of that. And now people are speaking up who would never have spoken up before. And I think it is the biggest political earthquake in Irish history in, I would say, 50 years.
Wow. And I'm speaking with Brian McCarthy, who's a contributor at the People's Cube. So so obviously the White House and President Trump are supporting this. And I think Americans who understand, you know, our perspective on the Trump mandate and the calls for mass deportation and all of this really support Ireland in this mission. So what happens next? I mean, when are the next elections, and what's the forecast now that this issue has risen to the fore?
Well, there's an election in Ireland coming up in the fall. It's not a parliamentary election, it's a presidential election. And Conor McGregor is going to have huge influence on that, no matter what anyone says, whether he runs or whether he becomes a kingmaker and designates someone. But there's two countries mentioned in the Irish proclamation, which is our Declaration of Independence: England, who we were breaking the connection with, and our exiled brothers and sisters in the United States. So Conor McGregor has kind of taken a leaf out of that and come to the United States to highlight the plight. And hopefully there are people of Irish descent and ancestry, there's 40 million of them who claim that here in the US, are going to say, wait a second, we'd like to go back there. We'd like our grandkids to go back there, our kids to go back there to visit, to see, you know, the home country. And it should be still the land of saints and scholars, but Irish people, it shouldn't be an encampment for people from all over the third world who are just going to want to go, hey, I'm going to live in Ireland and live off the welfare state over there.
Yeah, and I mean, this, again, should just be Ireland first. And how do you anticipate that the United States and President Trump might support this? Because, you know, he is not going to be shy in giving some of his opinions, Conor McGregor at the White House.
The biggest political event on the Irish political calendar is the White House every St. Patrick's Day. It becomes quite a joke because all the politicians run out of the country. They all come to the U.S. So that was the White House on St. Patrick's Day is the biggest stage for any Irish politician. And the fact that Conor turned up there has, you know, sent the country into a tailspin, basically. And I would hope that people in this country are going to start paying more attention, because every single Irish political party who's ever wanted to achieve anything has come to the United States to fundraise, for influence, for power, to meet with the movers and the shakers. And he just went straight to the top, just like Trump. Never ran for anything. He never, you know, got involved in anything. But he just came out of the traps and went straight to the most powerful man in the world and spoke out there and has literally, he's probably not someone that I'm going to tell my kids, you know, he's a great role model. But at the same time, I'll shake the guy's hand if and when I meet him and tell him, you know, well done. I'm so proud of what you have highlighted in Ireland.
Yeah, and this sounds a lot like almost the Irish version of Trump, where, you know, it's somebody who had a completely different rise to fame outside of traditional politics, you know, didn't go up through the ranks and like Trump. And so this is somebody who is an outsider to the establishment, but who's coming in and making a lot of headlines. And I think that at least for, you know, most of our listeners who are here in America, even though people can listen worldwide on our app, most of our listeners, it's not necessarily something that we're paying attention to every day, but I think it matters ultimately because where Western civilization goes and where all of these countries go really does impact the entire world stage. And we should be paying attention to a lot of these headlines. And so how can Conor McGregor now, you know, take this St. Patrick's Day victory and really make headway moving into the fall elections there? I mean, whether he runs or not.
I just think he issued an ultimatum to the Irish government, actually, on Twitter yesterday or the day before. And he said, you're going to have to come up with a plan in 12 days to close our borders, to do something. So he it wasn't a threat. It was just an ultimatum. So he clearly has stuff up his sleeve. And his whole message by coming to the United States has said to the Irish government, if you don't stop mass immigration into our tiny little island of 5 million people, I ran the math last week. The amount of people that have come into Ireland, I think it would be the equivalent of 60 million coming into the U.S. So, you know, we have a distinct culture in Ireland and, we'd like to protect it. There's nothing wrong with that. And me as an immigrant, I've come to the United States. I've kept some of my Irishness, but I've also assimilated into the culture here, and my kids have. So, you know, we'll put up with a certain amount of immigration, but he's certainly going to, he's not afraid. I'll say that about the guy. He is definitely not afraid. He's from a working class community in Ireland, and that's why the elites sneer at him. They sneer at his accent. They sneer at his education. And you'll notice the patterns, just like Donald Trump. They look down their nose at him, but he's got nothing to lose, just like Trump. So he's going to cause major, major political upset in Ireland, and the entire establishment now is focused on destroying him.
Wow, it really sounds like a Donald Trump story, and maybe his campaign slogan for either himself or if he decides, as you mentioned, to be a kingmaker, will be "Make Ireland Great Again." And
yes,
that would
he has
be
that.
He already does. That's see,
no,
that's,
he has "Make Ireland Great Again" hats, and he has them in green, and he when you want to upset and destroy the establishment and turn politics on its head, it would appear there is only one political consultant on the planet that you go to for that advice, and it's Donald J. Trump.
Yeah, and I mean, he is just a phenomenon that I think has really spoken to the will of the people and people who are oppressed by government. I mean, this is why the Trump mandate was so successful, I think, in 2024, and hopefully why the people of Ireland will get rid of their establishment and have a government that actually has their best interests in mind. So I really appreciate it, Brian McCarthy. We'll look forward to talking with you again as all of this continues and as we get closer to the Irish election. But we'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Thank you.
As we celebrate the many pro-life victories going forward, we rejoice. Preborn's network of clinics have a unique opportunity to advance even further without political persecution. But what does this look like? Preborn is the greatest threat to the abortion industry by rescuing on average 200 babies' lives a day, and they are putting a serious dent into the abortion holocaust. But there are still thousands of babies who are slain daily, and Preborn's goal is to rescue them all. With the help of the pro-life community, meaning you and me, we can save so many more. Please join us in saving all of these precious lives. The ultrasound is the game changer. Once a mother hears that precious heartbeat, she is twice as likely to choose life. If you consider yourself pro-life, we need your help. One ultrasound is just $28. Five ultrasounds are $140. $5,000 sponsors ultrasounds for the entire Preborn network for an entire day. So how many lives can you save? Every child is a beautiful gift from God, so please join this cause. To donate securely, please dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby, or visit preborn.com/AFR. That's preborn.com/AFR.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. Well, the JFK docs, or around 80,000 of them, were dropped at the National Archives link online earlier this week. And the headline coming from Just the News is JFK docs offer colorful details of Lee Harvey Oswald's life in the USSR and shed light on U.S. intel ops. But did we actually learn anything from this entire repository that we didn't know already? Well, interestingly, now FBI Director Kash Patel had said last year with Glenn Beck that he's read the JFK files, and what we need to know may not actually be revealed. This is Cut 6.
The problem is the things that we can't release have nothing to do with the questions you guys are asking. That's about as far as I can go on it. But like the answers you guys want, you pretty much have them. There's very minimal stuff that can't be seen from things that you wouldn't even think are related to that.
So let's welcome in John Cardillo, who is a GOP strategist and former NYPD. And John, I don't know whether what Cash was talking about last year has now been released in these 80,000 documents, but it would seem to suggest to me that if he's read files that exist, that what's in this repository, which was really, in my opinion, kind of a giant nothing burger in terms of, you know, anything having to do with the assassination itself. It was just, you know, a lot of maybe other interesting historical tidbits and other things. But it would seem to me that if that kind of a bombshell revelation that Cash was talking about was released in the 80,000 documents, we would have gotten a much juicier headline by now. So what in your view is going on?
Well, good to be with you, Jenna. As always, I think this is pretty simple when you don't hang your hopes on these grand revelations of every conspiracy theory. People have to be, let me say it like this. I don't think people know how things work if they really think they're going to find out every one of Epstein's clients and everything surrounding the JFK assassination. I mean, look, what we know historically is that, yeah, organized crime wanted JFK dead. For a bunch of reasons. The number one reason was JFK, Sam Giancana, who was the boss of the Chicago La Cosa Nostra, the mafia, and one of the most powerful mob bosses in the country, helped JFK win the election. And to say thanks, JFK appointed his brother Bobby Kennedy attorney general. Bobby Kennedy went after the mob, including Giancana and his people, with a vengeance. They also were upset about Cuba and losing all that casino revenue. And the CIA as well, for a bunch of reasons at the time. So we know that that organized crime and the CIA certainly wanted JFK dead. The issue is, has there ever been a definitive link? No, and I don't think there ever will be. Because if it happened that way, which is the conventional wisdom, and if you look at it through an investigative lens, it's the most plausible scenario. That means the U.S. government, in some fashion, had a hand in assassinating a president. And no one is ever going to tell the American people that story because it would throw the country into chaos. You know, in the 1960s, we didn't have the internet. We didn't have X. We didn't have Reddit. We didn't have all these boards where people can go off on tangents and do their own investigation. But if that came to light today, there would be a complete, I mean, people don't trust institutions as it is, right? There would be an utter and complete breakdown. So I think we've seen as much as we are ever going to see with regards to JFK, Epstein, et cetera.
Well, so, and I agree with you on that premise that it's the most plausible scenario that our own government had something to do with this and was very intimately involved. There are suggestions as well that, you know, LBJ even ordered it, ordered the hit, whether, you know, and all of these are, of course, best guesses until we actually see the proof. But, you know, I was talking to another guest recently about this, and his view, John, was actually the opposite of what you're saying in terms of a complete and utter breakdown, because, and what he was saying is that the reason that Trump can release the files now is because Americans already distrust our institutions. They're already seeing what Doge is uncovering. They already don't like the establishment. And so if we said, you know, hey, back in the 60s, the CIA was part of this, then most of the American people would be like, well, that checks out. We kind of knew that. Thanks for confirming. This just confirms why we need to continue to, you know, rid the establishment from taking over in Washington. So, you know, what's your view on why this would cause more of a giant crisis if it's just confirming what a lot of people suspect already?
Look, I don't disagree with that, but there's a very big difference between suspecting something and having it in black and white. But here's the elephant in the room that nobody really wants to acknowledge. Why are people assuming, and why have people assumed for the last 2 years, that the people involved in this would ever tell anyone they were involved in it? Why are they assuming that there was cooperation with investigators at the time? Why are they assuming that people that were put on that commission weren't put there because they knew what happened and their job was to obfuscate the truth? You know, most bad guys don't voluntarily give up evidence, right? I mean, when we go after, you know, we're talking about the mob maybe being involved. When we go after La Cosa Nostra, there are Title III trap and trace warrants, right? They don't know. Those are sealed warrants. They don't know the government's looking at them, that law enforcement's looking at them. So they're not voluntarily giving up information on their operations. It's always been a little bit preposterous to me that people assumed, okay, there was this massive conspiracy to kill JFK, and then all of the players started getting chatty and disclosing all this stuff to the commission that was just from the American public, but common knowledge to government. I mean, I think this was, if this was a government operation or a combined effort with government and organized crime, this would have been a very tight-lipped operation. Other people were probably killed that were lower profile that nobody paid any attention to in conjunction. If they started to get chatty, I doubt the players gave up enough intel for there to ever be a definitive conclusion. That's why I've always taken this stuff with a grain of salt. So I don't disagree with your last guess that we distrust institutions. But speculating and having it in black and white are two very different things. And I don't think there was ever testimony given or evidence uncovered that enabled it to be put into black and white.
Yeah, fair enough. And I agree with you certainly that the confirmation of conspiracy theories is a very different landscape than people just believing them, certainly. And I also agree with you that, you know, when people are saying things, you know, releasing the JFK files, releasing the Epstein files, for example, I mean, this assumes that these the people who were responsible for this, and, you know, and Epstein and whoever, you know, the assassins were and all of this, that they operated kind of like Disney villains, right? Where they say right. their entire scheme in a quippy song, and they write their list out, and they leave, you know, their just troves of evidence, like on Law and Order, where, you know, they come in and it's like it's all neatly wrapped up in a bow. And anybody like, you know, you and I who've actually, you know, have experience in law enforcement and criminal law and some of these things, we know that that's not how it happens in the real world. And so for people who are just waiting for, you know, the one document that will prove this, like the neat bow in the Hollywood script, I don't think that actually exists.
I'm with you 100%. I mean, look, and if you want to, you know, go to Epstein, right? I mean, I'm convinced that Epstein was a state actor. I'm convinced Epstein was being run by our government, the Israeli government. I tie the Israelis in, not because of all the crazy anti-Semitism on Twitter, but we know Ghislaine Maxwell's dad, Robert Maxwell, was a Mossad asset for years. That's come out. Retired members of the Mossad have admitted as much. Not uncommon for a wealthy, internationally connected guy to be an intelligence asset. It can do great things for their business, right? Because they'll feed them information back on competitors, et cetera. So it happens more than people think. But so when you look at Epstein's lifestyle, the takeaway to me that the media never really focused on with Epstein, Jenna, was that when he died, his estate was only $57 million plus some expensive real estate. You cannot live that lifestyle if you've got a liquid estate of $57 million. His jet was burning $1 million in fuel a month the way he was flying a 727 back and forth to that island, fuel and maintenance. Some massive actors were subsidizing Epstein's lifestyle, buying islands. You talk to anybody on Wall Street, nobody knew the guy. The guy was not a major player. You talk to any of the major players on Wall Street, investment banking, trading. Epstein was not Madoff. Everybody knew. He was a known commodity. He was a giant. Everyone knew Madoff. No one knew Epstein. So when you start to, using process of elimination, you start to realize, it's pretty strong evidence that he was a state actor being subsidized by governments to acquire compromat on people that they could later use to, you know, achieve their end, right? No one's going to tell us that. The people tasked with keeping that information and disseminating it were the people running the op. They're not documenting this. They're not going to testify in committees to this and admit to it. And so you just nailed it. I mean, the evidence in you know, readable form, in searchable form, just doesn't exist, in my opinion.
Yeah, and I think that's unfortunately going to be the lackluster conclusion to a lot of this. And, you know, and it gives Trump and Pam Bondi and Tulsi Gabbard, you know, frankly, a really good headline to say, hey, we're being super transparent. We're releasing all the documents. I mean, I'm all for that. And great. You know, the American people deserve to know what's there. And I think the point of this story, though, overall, is that nothing that truly exists is likely being hidden from the public. But let's go back real quick to what Kash Patel said. And he's claiming, and I believe him, that he's read the JFK files. But when he's saying, you know, the answers that you want to know, like you're not even looking in the right places and stuff, was that a little bit more Hollywood style bluster? Or are there, do you think, documents that have yet to be revealed that do maybe contain some answers? Or how do we fit that response into this puzzle?
Well, I'll say this, right? Kash Patel was number two at DNI's office, so he had access to pretty much everything he wanted during that tenure. But also, you got to remember, and I love that Kash Patel is at the FBI, but you got to remember that for a little while there after the 2020 election, Kash Patel went to the QAnon side of the world, and he was making a lot of money selling merch, et cetera. So some of the statements he made back then, I take with a grain of salt, because I understand he was appealing to a certain portion of the far-right base that loves this stuff, and they were, you know, they were buying his gear, they were subscribing to his content, and so a teaser like that in the media world, you know this, I know this, right? A teaser like that from a guy that was at his level can be pretty lucrative in your monthly subscriber base growing, and so I don't know how much stock I put in the statement in that clip.
Yeah, and I think that's a fair assessment. And for, you know, a lot of people who are, you know, huge Cash fans, I mean, I'm really glad that he's at the FBI. Frankly, I'm an even bigger fan of Dan Bongino being there as the deputy director.
Yeah.
I think they're going to make a lot of really good headway in terms of, you know, everything that Cash was saying at his confirmation hearing and all that. But we do need to take a lot of this with a grain of salt to kind of put it in the realistic real world perspective that, again, this isn't, you know, made for Hollywood drama as much as probably future scripts are going to make their way into Hollywood with that overall point. But, just kind of in closing here before we let you go, John Cardillo. So, you know, what should we realistically then expect from the conclusion to some of this? Because I think for the people who want to see this kind of bombshell stuff, they're never going to get that satisfaction, likely. And so how do we maybe tamper that expectation other than this conversation while still giving Trump, I think, the valid PR win that he's trying to bring transparency to the government as much as is possible?
Look, I think Trump at Bondi and Patel did here was great. I think it was great. Ratcliffe over at FBI, Tulsi at DNI. They were transparent. They're not responsible for the content of these files. They weren't around 62 years ago, 61 years ago when the commission started investigating. They weren't responsible for any of this content. They're releasing what they have. So, yeah, I think they deserve all the credit in the world, and it's a massive PR win for them. You can't blame them because, you know, 60-year-old evidence just isn't there. That's not their fault. And I would say the same with the Epstein files, right? I mean, Epstein was operational at its highest peak in the early going into, 2000 to 2008 is when he was really operating heavily, late 90s, maybe a little before that. None of these people were in office. None of these people had power. So you can't blame them because other administrations years back and in some cases half a century plus back, obfuscated or buried evidence or simply didn't collect it. So I think they deserve all the credit in the world and no blame for what's not in the files.
Yeah, really well said. Well, John, I always appreciate you bringing, a dose of reality to these conversations as much as it might not be, the dramatized view of what people expect. Because, politics has become so entertainment focused. And I think a lot of what the overall MAGA movement, while it's great politics for like campaign stuff, it's not necessarily, we're not sitting here on an episode of The West Wing, right? And so bringing that kind of back to reality is a really important focus here. So I appreciate you joining for this conversation. And folks can follow John on X. I'd encourage you to do that. He posts a lot of really great commentary, especially about here in my home state of Florida. And speaking of that, Senator Jay Collins, a Florida state senator, is going to join us after the break on some important goings-on in the Florida legislature right after this.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And as promised, we are turning to the Florida legislature, which is in session and has a lot going on. So let's welcome in Senator Jay Collins from the great state of Florida, who has a brand new bill focusing on veterans. And this is so important, Jay, because, it seems like with all of the other news and all of the other things that are going on and, a lot of stuff is very important, obviously. Some of these types of topics tend to not be covered as much in the media, but they are important. So tell us about your bill and why.
So, Jenna, first off, thank you for having me on the show. Really appreciate it. Always love the opportunity to speak with you and share some good news from the great state of Florida. We have 1.4, coming up on 1.5 million veterans in our state. We love to call ourselves the most veteran-friendly state in America. And across our country, our veteran community is such a small demographic who has given so much, an incredible amount over the last 20, 25 years and still being asked to do more. So to your point, often in the wash of some of these large pieces of language, some of the volatility in our community, across our state in terms of politics, Yeah, these get washed out, but we have to do the right thing for our veterans. So what this focuses on is veteran transition, veteran benefits assistance. When you leave the military and you go through the VA process and you get your, you know, your VA compensation, whether it's 10% up to 100%, there is a very specific, very methodical way that this happens. The math is a little funky. If you're not aware of VA math, I would encourage you to dig into how the accountability of the math problem works. It will blow your mind. But that's what this bill is focused on. I want to make sure that our veterans have every single tool, whether it's themselves, a nonprofit, whether it's a for-profit that helps fill this void, to go ahead and make sure they get the benefits they need. Generally speaking, many veterans aren't able to get their max amount that they should be allocated from the VA the first time through. There's almost a soft requirement that you have to go back, reassess this, and reapply, and it just shouldn't be that way. We should get it right the first time.
Yeah, and this makes so much sense. And, I mean, are other states looking at doing this? Or, you know, now especially with Secretary Doug Collins, who, you know, is on the federal side, you know, I mean, this just seems like a no-brainer.
Yeah, Jenna, there's a lot of discussion right now in the veteran community. And, you know, we're coming at this point where there's a little bit of a fear factor. You know, personally, I want to radically overhaul the VA. I don't like the system. I don't believe that monolithic hospitals are the way to provide our veterans the best health care that they can get. I just don't. I think that a choice-driven system is the way to do that. I think you'll get much more effective care, get to pick your doctors, and end up, you know, doing so much better for so many more veterans. I would love to see a reutilization of those hospitals in a wraparound service system for veteran homelessness. I think as a VA or as states, that's a great way to use those properties, but I don't want the government running that system. I want those hospitals to be utilized and reshifted into it, but I want this to be a public-private partnership. There are so many great nonprofits focusing and working in this space right now, talking about Tunnel to Towers, Gary Sinise, Home for Heroes, people who have a genuine desire to make veterans' lives better. I'm not intentionally leaving anybody out. There's dozens and dozens. We can solve this problem and do it with more efficiency to get out there and take care of our veterans. But what I'd really like to do is see the money block budgeted from the federal government to the state and put the power with the states to give veterans the ultimate choice. Ultimately, they can choose a state that best fits their needs, takes care of them and their families, and puts them on a path to long-term success. And that's what this whole approach should really do. And yeah, with Secretary Collins, I think we're in a good spot. I think the discussion of radical shift and change to provide our veterans with more is right there for us, but we got to get the benefits system right when they transition out.
Yeah, and things like this are what states and even the federal government should be spending money on, not, you know, Arab Sesame Street and drag queen story time in other countries and all of this. And, you know, with DOGE and also with kind of a Florida version of DOGE, I think that balancing mm-hmm. the budget and actually having a surplus and what the DeSantis administration has accomplished with his tenure in office, I mean, then there can actually be money to spend on some of these priorities, like taking care of our veterans. So, you know, with the Florida legislature being in session now, and you know, it's a 60-day time frame. In terms of the budget and spending, when you look at the outrage nationally on the federal level, I think Florida has a really great plan. I mean, we're a state that doesn't have mm-hmm. a state income tax, and yet we have a surplus, and we can spend on good priorities. How should the Florida blueprint be mirrored in other states, but also even at the federal level with, I think, all of these revelations that we knew were there but are actually coming to light in tangible ways?
So, Jenna, that's a great question, and I'm going to use this veterans bill to walk that answer in. So this bill is Senate Bill 910. It's Veterans Benefit Assistance, and like most things, a lot of it has been vetted, improved, and put in place by the state of Florida, but it's moving up federally. You look at the connectability and the connection between what we're doing in Florida and now what's trying to be pushed at the federal level. It's pretty incredible. Look, Florida was DOGE before there was Doge, right? We are incredibly clean, incredibly focused on making sure that we hold people accountable. We, you know, minimize the request or the push for money from our tax system. And honestly, you know, we're shifting and paying off debt at just an astronomically amazing pace. The governor is a complete rock star for this. But I think if you listen to citizens, that's what they want from their federal government. We got to pay down our debt. We have to make sure we have a balanced budget. And our budget has shrank the last 3 years in a row while still performing tops in education, tops in new growth for businesses. Florida is a place people want to come, and it's because of this fiscally conservative approach that it's really happening. And, you know, that being said, there's still things we can do. Right now, we're looking at how can we use the law of large numbers to procure more efficiently, whether it's in IT, whether it's in vehicles, school buses, even weapon systems for our law enforcement. How can we get more savings and pass those on openly to make sure we don't take anything more from our taxpayers and they can keep their hard-earned money and live that American dream? You know, and, you know, we're talking about property tax. That's a huge thing right now. People would love to get there, and we are doing a ton of work to see how we can get rid of property tax, but we got to make sure we get this one right and sharpen our pencils before we pull that trigger.
Yeah, well, I'm definitely one who is as a resident and a homeowner in Florida that would love to see property taxes go away. I know that there's kind of a companion movement in Texas with Don Huffines, a former state senator, who's looking at that as well, and just arguing that, you know, we should be able to outright own our property without continuing to have to pay. And the rationale there makes sense, definitely. And, you know, these priorities that Florida is focused on, I think so many conservatives look to Florida as kind of the beacon of hope for the U.S. and want a lot of other red states, even blue states, even though they won't, to follow this model. And so for people who are listening nationwide, and they may even be frankly jealous going, man, Florida is where it's at. Yes, you're right. How would you encourage listeners to encourage their legislators to similarly have conservative priorities like what's going on in Florida?
So, you know, I think it's a three- or four-fold process. One, as leaders, you know, we know that anything not clearly enumerated in the Constitution should be a state's right issue. Where are those issues that your government federally is usurping power from the states? Let's identify that. I think we're all doing a good job there, right? And then let's find language in states like Florida, and Texas has done a few things as well. Let's grab that language, these functional bills, and start pushing them, understanding them, and having conversations with our local, state, and federal elected leaders. But in the end, it goes down to the ballot. We've got to elect people who understand what conservative means, stay true to our values, and remember that they serve the people. They take care of the future of our country by serving the people right now and listening to where we have to go. Ultimately, that's what we have to do. It all comes down to voting, and candidate quality matters. You got to get people who can understand the issues at hand, but you also have to have people who can register with a voter and win the hearts and minds, especially in some of these larger districts. Get out there, get involved, push your people. I can't say that enough.
Yeah, so well said. I'm speaking with Senator Jay Collins from the great state of Florida. And, you know, as the legislative cycle continues, there's a lot of, you know, good that is being championed, but also some things that I think really don't make a lot of sense. And I want to ask your opinion on this move to basically prevent Florida's own government agencies from clarifying the law on ballot initiatives. Basically, I think this is a direct response to Amendments 3 and 4 that thankfully failed because the people and the voters were actually educated on what these bills were really attempting to do, or these ballot initiatives, rather, were attempting to do, rather than just focused on the bill summaries, which can be very misleading. And it seems like it's not political one way or another to say, okay, this is the ballot initiative, but let's clarify the law so that people actually understand what it is that they're voting on. How is that in any way controversial?
You know, Jenna, that is a great question. I don't understand. You have to have faith in your process. You have to have faith in your system. And we know that a company tried to buy their way into amending the Constitution in the great state of Florida. That just shouldn't happen. And the way they leverage that and the way they misstruck the truth in many regards was gobsmacking. And I 100% agree with you. We have to get this right, and this should not be a political issue at all. This is just the right thing to do. And, you know, I believed in it so much that I tried to run that bill in a special session, and then we had another special session, and we worked through this. And there is a bill pushing through the process right now from our Ethics and Elections Committee that I know we're still chewing on, making some tweaks here and there. But hopefully we land that in a good spot. That's what we need to do to tie this up and just put the faith back in the public that our ballot initiatives, our election process are as strong and great as they should be, because excellence is a choice, I guess is what I would say. And we choose to do everything as excellent as we can, because that has to be what we owe our people. And we're going to get it right.
Yeah, absolutely. And with the kind of legislature that Florida has, with a supermajority and how much attention that has gotten nationwide and how conservative Florida is, ballot initiatives are the only real way, I think, that some of these nefarious actors, and also even just, you know, some of the few liberals that are left in Florida and the Democrats, are trying to push through their agenda to circumvent the legislature. I personally have a real big issue with ballot initiatives, just from a perspective that we're guaranteed a representative form of government. We should petition our legislators and not necessarily go around them, especially with ballot initiatives that can be bought. And so with the way that all of this can still function in the state of Florida, there's also legislation that is trying to cure some of these problems with ballot initiatives. What's going on with that, and where is that at with the Florida legislature?
So, you know, I spoke just a little bit about that. We had those special sessions, and we brought it back. We did hear that in our Ethics and Elections Committee. It is pushing through the process. There is more discussion on it. I expect that bill to move. At its current form, it doesn't do everything exactly how I want it to, but I think we're going to end up in a good spot, you know, working with stakeholders from everywhere, frankly, in the House, the Senate, and in the executive offices, to make sure that this thing is really tied in, because to your point, we got to get it right. And that should be popping up here in another committee soon. I don't have that in front of me, so I can't answer the specifics on that one, Jenna.
Yeah, well, no worries. I mean, for everybody listening who's in the state of Florida, you know, we should be paying attention to the social media, for example, of people like Senator Collins and others. We should be looking at the calendar, understanding, especially during the legislative cycle, when we can contributing, you know, go to those types of committee hearings and actually present testimony. But you can always call your legislators and encourage them to continue to do the right thing and to stand up for the conservative values that we all want to continue to see in Florida. And, you know, it was really funny to me. Your colleague, Senator Ingaglia, posted this morning a thing that the Democrats are trying to, like, carve a new pathway and, like, plan their comeback in Florida. And he was just laughing about it. And my response to that was from Mean Girls, which is like, they're trying to make fetch happen. Don't make fetch happen. But what do you see as the actual possibility as we're heading into a gubernatorial election next year? So, you know, the transition from the DeSantis administration, hopefully to a worthy successor that will continue the conservative legacy. But absolutely, and we need to be praying for that. What do you see as the likelihood that Florida even pays attention to anything that the Democrats are potentially trying to do in the state?
Well, I think that depends on what we as conservatives do. If we keep focused the right way, and we pay attention to the issues at hand, and we don't have infighting, I think that we're probably in a good space. But don't forget that not too long ago, Republicans were in the same position the Democrats are or were, right? The roles were flip-flopped. And ultimately, they had infighting. They had gaps. And they gave us opportunities to push through here with Governor DeSantis, and we have shifted this state in a way that's truly amazing. But we got to keep our foot on the gas. We can't do half-baked, soft-toss language. We've got to focus on conservative values, hit the things that we said we were going to do, you know, say what you mean and mean what you say. In the end, it's about getting things done. We got to put points on the board. We got to make sure that we don't let up, because everything can shift in just one moment. One issue happens on television. One issue ignites itself in the court of public opinion, and this all can shift immediately. And, you know, to tie this back into the veteran block, veteran discussion at the front, Jenna, you know, there are 952,173 claims currently listed as over 125 days. 241,601 claims are backlogged. Now, mind you, 200,000 veterans leave service each year. That voter block across our state is about 4.5 million people when you look at the associated people and families with them. This is why making sure we take care of those who take care of us, whose focus is on conservative values, solving problems, and keeping our state great, is so
and
vitally important.
And we got to lead it there, absolutely.
We'd like to thank our sponsors, including Preborn. Preborn has rescued over 200,000 babies from abortion, and every day their network clinics rescue 200 babies' lives. Will you join Preborn in loving and supporting young moms in crisis? Save a life today. Go to preborn.com.